Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining our team at Kivara Capital Partners tonight on what is our fourth COVID client communications call. I'm Doug Cioca, and on with me tonight from Kivara are Tom Bowling and John Nagle. Tom and Johnny and I will each be delivering some prepared remarks, and then we hope to open things up for Q&A. The hope caveat is purely a function of some issues we were having on our test run in being able to properly identify the caller. The conference call company is trying to troubleshoot this, so Tom will give us an update as we get to conclusion of the prepared remarks. So hopefully it will go off without a hitch. So right now you are all on listen-only mode, and if we do have a Q&A session, we'll give you the proper instructions, which are the same as on the first three calls, just pressing *9 to indicate your interest in asking a question to our switchboard. We'd also like to thank those who could not be with us on the call tonight, but who took the opportunity to send in questions both yesterday and today. We have a couple of those, and we will address those ahead of the Q&A session on the live. So let's jump in. I'd really like to begin this call in similar fashion to how we began our last call. And that call took place on May 19th. And that is by highlighting some of the pertinent data points and market statistics prevailing on the dates of each prior COVID client communications call. This will offer some perspective and thankfully demonstrate some progress as it relates to the capital markets and the economic battle against our ecological enemy. The first call was held on March 17th, but the mood of the market was neither celebratory nor intoxicating. The 17th was a Tuesday, and thankfully that day the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed higher by 1,050 points. However, that was nearly 2,000 points shy of what had been lost in the prior session. The intraday price fluctuations of that entire month were intense, and they were unprecedented. The 10-year bond had a yield of 1.08%, and the VIX, the gauge of investor fear and anxiety, was hovering near its all-time high of 82. The general mood of the market was one of anxiety and confusion. We all had learned the term shelter in place. Students were instructed not to return to class when their spring breaks ended, and our beloved March Madness was canceled. From its peak at that point, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 28%, starting from a record level, incidentally, which was attained on the 12th of February. The S&P 500 was down 25% from its top made on February 19th. The world had just been introduced to Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx. Lastly, this call took place 2 days after the Federal Reserve Bank announced an emergency interest rate cut, its second that month, taking the overnight lending rate literally to zero. 17,320 COVID tests were conducted that day in the United States, and 122 Americans had passed away from the coronavirus. The second call is held on April 2nd. We resisted the temptation to hold the call on the first, as we collectively felt we had already exhausted the expression, "You have got to be kidding me." The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 had both bottomed 1 week prior on the 23rd of March, yet still stood down 29% and down 27% from their prior highs, respectively. The yield on the 10-year bond had fallen to 0.58%, attributable to the momentous liquidity measures infused by the Fed, who literally every day brought more innovative and effective forms of monetary policy to keep the financial system afloat. The VIX gauge of investor fear and anxiety had dropped from 82 to 57. The first of several fiscal stimulus and rescue packages that just passed through Congress and the framework of its successor, that which contained the now well-known CARES Act provision and the even more popular PPP program, were in the final stages of formation. The lead story of the Washington Post that day, the great toilet paper shortage of 2020. It was the second day of a mandatory stay-at-home order in the state of Kansas, Kivara Capital's home state. 108,521 COVID tests were conducted on April 2nd in the United States, and cumulatively, 5,204 Americans had passed away from the coronavirus. The third COVID client client communication call took place on May 19th. Both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 were in rally mode off of their March 23rd lows, each moving up almost exactly 30% from that nadir. The Dow was still down 18% from its highs, and the S&P 500 was 14% below its peak. The yield on the 10-year bond perked up a bit and reached 0.69%. Fed Chair Jerome Powell and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin testified in front of a Senate subcommittee that morning, jointly presenting what would be dubbed the Quarterly CARES Act report to Congress. There had been much scrutiny on the timing and terms of the payroll protection plan loans being processed, and they were there to explain and defend the process. Despite the market's positive tone, the economic data was dragging. 3 days before our call, an April retail sales figure saw a drop of 16.4%, and durable goods orders had fallen over 17%. The VIX gauge of investor fear and anxiety continued falling, closed on May 19th at 30.53. Emotions in the market had distinctly come off the boil. The states of Colorado, Georgia, Texas, and Florida had been the first to lift their stay-at-home orders, and the country was captivated by the consequences. 401,339 COVID tests were conducted that day in the United States, and cumulatively, 86,432 Americans had passed away from the coronavirus. That brings us to today. Year-to-date, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 7.8%, while the S&P 500 is actually positive for the year by just under 0.5%. Though both indices remain well below their peak levels by 10% and 4% respectively, the underlying strength of the markets has been incredible. The 10-year bond is yielding 0.5%, as the prospect of a rate increase anytime soon was summed up well yesterday by Chairman Powell when during a post-meeting press conference he said, and I quote, "We are not even thinking about raising interest rates," end quote. The VIX gauge of fear and anxiety sits now at 24.1, and there seems to be as much talk about market complacency as there is about market anxiety, despite the second quarter economic contraction coming in this morning at minus 32%. Schools around the country are scrambling to put plans in place for the upcoming fall semester, and infection outbreaks in many states are heightening the prospects of reversing or stalling some of their reopening initiatives. 839,868 COVID tests were conducted yesterday in the United States, and cumulatively just over 150,000 Americans have passed away from the coronavirus. So you could be forgiven if, in light of the economic and epidemiological data points, you are a bit puzzled by the underlying stock market strength. To that very end, John Nagel put out a very compelling piece last month entitled, "Are the Markets Too Positive for the Situation?" with the essence of the research attempting to reconcile the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. Known as a leading indicator, the stock market tends to preemptively reflect the emergent optimism or pessimism embedded in economic data and carries on consistently, but only with economic corroboration. There's been a combination of monetary policy intervention, fiscal policy extravagance, and savvy science to set the predictive powers of the market in a positive motion. But we sit now at a critical inflection point as we incorporate important information into our outlook for the balance of the year. A significant input of such will be the constructs of the recent round of stimulus, the spending being kicked around in Congress, most notably the determination of an extension of unemployment benefits for workers displaced by the pandemic. Congressional recess is set to begin August 7th, which is a full week after the lapse of the benefits extended to those who qualified for income assistance in the April rescue package. Closing this gap is going to be critical to restoring confidence in consumer spending, which comprises the largest portion of the domestic economy. It is important as it relates to data that the market must digest. The concepts of better or worse are far more important to it than good or bad. So continuing to exceed expectations on the economic front. Amazingly, this morning's GDP print of minus 32% positively exceeded the expectations of minus 35%. And it is incumbent upon the market to broaden its leadership to incorporate companies, sectors, and sizes that have thus far been absent from its ascendancy. John Nagle is now going to discuss some of these market internals in much greater detail. John?
Thanks, Doug. Let's break down the returns we've seen across markets so far this year. Obviously, it's been an extremely eventful year. We've seen a tale of two markets for the first quarter versus the second quarter in this month. As Doug mentioned, the S&P is now actually up for the year after a crash in March. So what's driven the market during 2020 as a whole? Number one, the undeniable theme is the narrow leadership of the market. The S&P 500, as we commonly refer to as the market, is being carried by just a few companies. The five largest companies in the index, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, better known as Google, and Facebook, now make up about 22% of the index versus a historical average of about 14% for the top five market caps at any time. This level of top heaviness for the S&P 500 was last observed in March of 2000 when the five largest companies were Microsoft, General Electric, Cisco, Intel, and ExxonMobil. They made up 18% of the market. So it's rare to see such concentration at the top. The current top five companies this year are up an average of 28.6% year-to-date through yesterday's close. The other 495 companies are down on average 8% in that time frame. So we see that the biggest companies are among the best performing stocks for the year. When this happens, the headline numbers will look better than the broader underlying market. For a more technical term, this market lacks breadth. Essentially, diversification into a larger basket of stocks is typically resulting in underperformance versus the index returns so far this year. Another way to view this is comparing the traditional market cap weighted S&P 500 versus the equal weighted S&P 500. So just assigning the same weight to each component of the S&P 500. Again, the market cap weighted S&P 500 is up slightly for the year. The equal weighted S&P 500, again, same companies just weighted differently, is down 5.6% for the year. That's through yesterday. So this is a simple decomposition of the market. What really makes up that headline number that is universally quoted and how it can be a little misleading and disconnected from the rest of the market, and especially right now, the economy we're experiencing. How did we just have one of the largest quarterly drops in GDP in history and the market is flat? The answer partially is the dominance of the largest companies. We also see a level of concern from investors regarding the health of the market if just a limited number of stocks are doing well, or that any weakness in these large companies will pull the entire market down with them. Going back to the March 2000 observation, when we saw similar concentration and influence of the top five companies, that period going forward 2 to 3 years from March 2000 is not very good for the market. So is this a warning signal for the market as a whole? We'd say that no, it's not ideal. Like Doug said, we'd like to see broader participation from the entire market. However, let us break an investing rule and say this time is different. These companies and their fundamentals are different. Generally speaking, they are cheaper on a valuation basis, and they contribute their share of earnings much more substantially than the companies did back then. So we have a little less concern at the top heaviness at this point. And you can see, given that Apple, Amazon, Google, and Facebook actually just released earnings this afternoon, and they all beat estimates in the midst of a recession, you can reason that these companies have significant staying power as leadership for the market. But that being said, we still view diversification across different asset classes, styles, sectors, geographies, et cetera, as a critical piece of portfolio management to reduce risk and volatilities. So moving away from the S&P 500, the other major benchmarks for the market, the strongest area, the strongest major headline number is the NASDAQ composite, which is heavy in technology stocks. It was up 18% through yesterday and has reached multiple new all-time highs this summer. On the other hand, like Doug said, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 7%, and the weakest area of the market, small caps, represented by the Russell 2000, remains down 9.4% for the year through yesterday. Growth stocks continue to lead value stocks as they have for the past 3 years. Growth is up 15% for the year versus value down 12.4%. This 27% gap is historic. If it holds, it will be the widest gap in growth outperformance since 1999. Through the end of the second quarter, the three-year outperformance for growth over value is 48.6%, the largest outperformance over a trailing three-year period since, again, 1999. In our view, this is mainly a sector story. Growth is made up of technology, communications, internet, consumer discretionary, and healthcare companies. These companies have risen in spite of lofty valuations with exceptional top and bottom line growth driven by secular tailwinds in the economy. On the opposite end of the spectrum, value stocks, heavily weighted towards financials, consumer staples, energy, utilities, and including decimated groups like department stores and big box retailers, have struggled against secular headwinds. Falling interest rates and commodity prices, low inflation, increased regulation, and shifting consumer preferences and behaviors. For 2020 so far, the technology sector has led, producing a 17.8% return through yesterday, followed closely by consumer discretionary at 15.3%. Then by healthcare and communication services, which includes a lot of the internet companies, both returning over 5% for the year. The laggards are those value type sectors. Energy, still down, now down 35.7% for the year, and financials down 19.3% through yesterday's close. Consumer staples land in the middle, returning 1% for the year as of yesterday. Given the large divergence between growth and value and large cap and small cap, there is, in our view, a rebalancing or tactical opportunity in the short term to see some catch up from these weaker areas of the market that are still depressed from their levels to begin the year. We referenced the early cycle playbook on the last call, and that is during the recovery phase, which we possibly could be in now or at least are entering shortly, it appears that we are. Part of that playbook that we typically see is outperformance from small cap and value stocks in that recovery phase. It remains to be seen if that playbook works this time. Again, the dominance of the mega cap companies today is different, but historically, diversification works better early in the cycle, during the recovery, and than it does late in the cycle, which we just experienced. Globally, the same growth over value phenomenon is taking place. Given that global markets, particularly Europe, are more value stock oriented than U.S. market, international equities have underperformed U.S. for the year. The MSCI EAFE index, the developed countries index, is down 6.4% through yesterday. The MSCI emerging markets index has performed better, driven by China's rebounding stock market, and was down just 1% year-to-date through yesterday. Moving to fixed income, particularly high-quality bonds like U.S. Treasuries, government agencies, and municipals are performing well year-to-date, given the drop in interest rates that we've seen and the flight to quality that we saw in the first quarter. The Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Bond Index is up 7.5% for the year through yesterday. Credit experienced a period of turmoil during March. Corporates, both investment grade and below investment grade, sold off drastically. However, since then, corporates have seen a full recovery. Investment grade corporates are now up 9.6% for the year. High yield corporates are slightly positive through yesterday. The result of this historically low yield environment is historically low return expectations for bonds, which makes the fixed income market as it stands today one of, if not the greatest challenges in portfolio management for us over the long term. How do we own bonds if they're not paying anything? We have to view bonds in two lenses. One, for the diversification benefits they offer to stocks. Bonds historically serve as a ballast for a portfolio and a volatility reducer in times of distress for stocks. And the second is their role as income producers, which is unfortunately extremely low for bond investors. So it's important to maintain the first role as capital preservers and to not stretch for yield by taking on too much risk. To wrap up the market recap, we'll look at an area of the markets that we don't discuss as much, but they're back in the spotlight, which are precious metals. Recently, gold and silver prices have seen a significant rise. This logically follows a period when we've seen trillions in unfunded spending added to the U.S. federal deficit, causing some angst surrounding the U.S. dollar. Gold and silver through yesterday are now up 27% and 33% respectively year-to-date, as they are typically seen as safe havens versus a deterioration in purchasing power of fiat currencies like the U.S. dollar. Gold has hit its highest level since 2011, not coincidentally a time that came after another round of intense spending around and after the global financial crisis. We'll have more on precious metals and how they fit as investable assets later in the call during the Q&A session. But for now, let's shift gears to the healthcare side of things. Tom Bowling has an update on our monitoring of the pandemic data. Tom?
Thank you, John. Nice recap. You know, throughout each of the past three calls, we've had a segment on the coronavirus tracking, whether it be testing, cases, hospitalizations, et cetera. And one might ask, well, why such an emphasis in this area? If you take a step back, one of the keys to investment success over the long term is an investor's temperament, the ability to stick to a strategy through good times and bad. How do you develop a strong investor temperament? Well, we believe it's through data, whether it's economic data, asset class information, and in this case, data as it relates to this virus. The economy is in a medically induced coma because of this pandemic. So it's important for us as investors to track the virus data to get a feel for, to Doug's earlier point, it's more about better or worse than good or bad. Is the data trending in the right direction? Are we some of the measures that are being implemented as it relates to controlling the outbreak, are they having a positive effect? So that's one of the reasons we've placed such a large emphasis on tracking this data. And thankfully, the availability of data points in this area is widespread. So just a real quick recap, I'm going to focus on testing, cases, hospitalizations, deaths, in a new area that we've been watching, the rate of transmission. First, as it relates to testing, if we reflect back on our first call on March 17th, we had daily testing in the 17,000 range in March of this year. So it was definitely an area that was just ramping up, and the importance of which was being recognized, and more importantly, the scientific community was developing new technologies and testing capabilities that were so slowly being rolled out. If you fast forward today, or yesterday, we did over 840,000 tests. So a lot of progress in the last several months. And with the exception of just a few areas of the country, the positivity rate has declined considerably as the testing rate has gone up. So that's a positive takeaway for sure. Now, one of the correlations to testing is cases, right? So as we've seen a higher rate of testing, it's natural that we'll see a higher rate of new cases. In again, back to March 17th, we had daily new cases in the 3,600 range. And fast forward to today, it's over 65,000 new cases. Certainly a concerning number. We had reached a point in mid-May when cases were consistently on the decline. And as we know, as the economy began to open up, people became a little more comfortable with getting out and about. We've seen a spike in cases. Thankfully, the spike in cases has not materialized to a similar spike in the death rate that we saw back in late March, early April. We are seeing hospitalizations increase. If we look at hospitalizations on March 17th, it's amazing to think with all that was going on in the markets and so forth, we only had 325 people hospitalized in this country. We fast forward that today, it's around 57,000. Hospitalizations reached a peak so far this year, on April 15th of this year, at just shy of 60,000. So we're hospitalizations are close to where we were back in April. However, the daily death rate, which is a terrible term, but one that we've tracked, hit a peak in April of this year at 2,400 deaths, and the moving average, the 7-day moving average, was just over 2,000. So with the same amount of hospitalizations as we experienced in April, are we seeing the same death rate on a moving average? And the answer is no, it's about half. So currently the moving average on 7-day moving average on deaths is less than 1,000, 968. It is true that the death rate tends to lag hospitalizations. So as we continue to see, if there is an increase in hospitalizations, it's just natural that we'll see the death rate go up. However, the data most recently, and this is probably the impact of some areas of the country rolling back some of the economic reopenings in their locales, we've seen the case rate peak and hospitalizations peak just last week. It's a small sample size, but we're starting to see a turn in that data, which should lead to a peak in the death rate and hopefully a turn lower on that data point. So again, it's been interesting to track the data from over the series of calls we had the last few months. On the positive side, we are seeing cases plateauing, which means hospitalizations are plateauing, but we are yet to have seen the death rate begin to move lower. So that is hopefully a development that will happen over the next few days, because it certainly has a lagged effect. A new data point that we've been focused on over the last several weeks is what we call the transmission rate. So if you think about one person contracting the virus, how many people are they then passing it along to? There's a great website out there that tracks the transmission rate, and the data point that is the main focus is an individual passing it to one or more other individuals or less? And if it's over one, right, so if I'm transmitting the virus to one or more people, that leads to a greater incidence of outbreak. If it's below one, if I'm transmitting it to less than one person, then cases will be on the decline because of that. So about a month ago, we had only 14 states across the country that had a transmission rate under one. That was quite concerning. That was at a time when we were beginning to think about hotspots or still seeing hotspots across the country. Now, a month later, we're up to 20 states that has a transmission rate of under one. So again, that is a trend that's positive and one that we're watching pretty closely. I'll point out that Arizona, Florida, Texas, South Carolina, and Georgia, five states that have been considered hotspots around the country, are now at a less than one transmission rate. So it's a very, very positive data point. Last thing, so we've talked about, and we might have some of this data to disseminate after the call, but ultimately, we're all focused on providing a bridge to a vaccine. And that's what both the Fed and Congress is up to with all the fiscal stimulus that's been provided. How do we get this country out of this medically induced coma to a vaccine, and what's the time frame look like? Well, the good news is we have currently across the world, there's 165 vaccines in some stage of development. And more importantly, there are six vaccines in the critical phase three trial stage, most of which have kicked off this month. In fact, University of Kansas here locally is participating in a vaccine trial with thousands of patients signing up. So we're hopeful, based on the speed of which we've gotten to phase three with a lot of these providers, it's likely that by the end of the year, we could have some very constructive data on a vaccine. And because of the Operation Warp Speed that we're under, hopefully production is following that progress to be able to distribute a vaccine to a wide swath of the population at a very a quick pace. So again, just to recap on some of the data, we think it's important. It's something that we track on a daily basis. And just one side note, as we talk about, again, this bridge from when the virus first took hold in late February, early March, to where we are now, to where we're going in terms of finding a vaccine. It's clear that what the Fed and the Congress are doing in terms of providing this bridge is working. We got a very somber GDP report here recently of negative 32% on an annualized basis. But when you look at spending data, specifically consumer spending data, and J.P. Morgan does a consumer spending tracker, there's been a lot of improvement in terms of consumer spending because obviously unemployment benefits have contributed, stimulus checks have contributed, the PPP program has kept people on the payroll. Obviously, the economic reopening in parts of the country that feel that's appropriate has helped. So the J.P. Morgan Daily Consumer Spending Tracker troughed in late March at negative 40% on a year-over-year basis. It's a pretty remarkable number. Right now, that consumer spending tracker is down 10% on a year-over-year basis. So there's been almost a 30% recovery in consumer spending over the last 90 days. We think that momentum will be reflected in next quarter's GDP number, which could be quite robust. I'm going to stop there. Doug's going to spend just a few minutes on the focus has not shifted away from the virus, but we're getting a lot of questions on the pending election this fall. So he's going to spend a few minutes on that.
Thanks, Tom. I feel like I should call you Dr. Tom. And Tom's right. We're a little more than 3 months from the presidential election. And as you'd suspect, bets are beginning to line up on the outcome, both for the occupant of the White House, but also the congressional composition. It's funny, when we have had periodic pullbacks and disruptions in this market progression, it is tempting for a lot of the talking heads to attribute a portion of that to the prospects of a Biden or a Trump presidency based upon their perceived platform. It's very early to know the lineup. It's very early to make any tactical changes to investment portfolios, and we are resisting the temptation to engage in doing so. We think through the prototypical areas of strength, should there be, as seems likely right now in the combined polling data, a Biden victory and a less certain, if as certain as any poll can be, but also somewhat likely shift congressionally for the Democrats to potentially take a hold of the Senate. Known in the media as the big blue wave, should that sum of probability greater than zero be assigned to that taking place, clients would have been picking our brains about what that would look like. The short answer is it's impossible to know between executive order and a Senate composition that does or does not possess filibuster power of the party in the minority. But were a Biden presidency to take place, there are certain industries that would historically stand to do well. Clean energy is a common one. Companies that make batteries and electronic vehicles would likely be eligible for greater subsidies in an administration that looks like that. Infrastructure spending would seem very likely to be green-lighted and be green-lighted reasonably quickly. That is actually very positive for our country, given the amount of industrial production that now takes place there, particularly with some supply lines that have shifted courtesy of COVID. It also seems likely that trade tensions would chill. There's no question that Trump, in his deal-making posture, takes a very rigid negotiating stance that may not in the short term be a direct benefit to a lot of our companies that sell their goods and services internationally. I think that a Biden administration would likely be less ideological and maybe more practical in negotiating. That would be a short-term benefit, but sadly could take us back to positions that are disadvantageous in the long term. So that would be an area that would likely be in flux. It seems likely also that if a Biden victory were to take place, taxes would go up. We actually think that regardless of who wins in 2020, taxes at some point are going to have to go up. Not only are they at a lower end of the historical spectrum, although it doesn't feel like it, they definitely have to be adjusted at some point to address the deficit and the spending that has taken place justifiably to assist in stabilizing the economy during this downturn. There's an old theory, and it's old and it's not theoretical, but it's time-tested that markets tend to like divided government. There's this concept of constructive gridlock, where there'd be a Democratic president in a Republican House and Senate, or a Republican president in a Democratic House and Senate. Well, and this will be in the notes that we send out subsequent to the call, but that actually is a market's favorite combination, one variation thereof, of divided government and a split in control. So it's very early, as we know. We do feel like if the president that takes office does not prioritize the economy, there will be a referendum in the second year of the first term, in the midterm elections. This happened in the administration of Bill Clinton in 1992, a Democratic president, Senate, and House, until the 94 midterms when the Republicans took control of both. Enter Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton and he, representative constructive government, compromise, and effective influence possibly on the economy. 1980, Ronald Reagan took office, and really the great ascendancy and prosperity of the American economy that began in 1980 and ended in 1999, the greatest period of economic prosperity on record, really didn't get traction until 1982. Republican House and Senate and Republican president, overhaul in the midterms, enter Tip O'Neill, he and Ronald Reagan, constructive government, compromise, and economic prosperity. Same thing happened with Barack Obama in 2008. So there is precedent to see with an administration not prioritizing economic growth and job creation that voters tend to realign that mandate a little bit more constructively, which tends to line up favorably with what the market would expect historically. Lastly, comments that both John, Tom, and I all made referenced the Federal Reserve Bank and their interest in keeping interest rates low. They put out something called a dot plot at the end of every Fed meeting, the last of which concluded yesterday. The dot plot is a graphical representation of the Fed's outlook on the direction of interest rates and the specific targets each voting member maintains. As they see it today, there is an expectation that rates will not go up until 2022. That is a very strong historical tailwind for risk assets. If for no other reason is that the bar to exceed a cost of capital with a higher rate of return or return on equity is very low. It's achievable. And frankly, savers are punished by earning no interest, which motivates them to take market risk. So we will tune in with another call as we get closer to the election. Certainly some dates are right around the corner with the conventions on the horizon. We likely think that Joe Biden's running mate will be selected in the course of the next 2 to 3 weeks. So when we put together the platform and the agenda for the next call, we'll have more to say along these lines. But right now, we're very dubious of any polls. We think it's too early to be tactical, and we feel very fortunate the Fed has kept rates very low. So unfortunately, the Q&A issue that we encountered when we began the call has not been resolved. We do have two questions that were sent in. John is going to take one and Tommy the other. And then unfortunately, we'll have to wrap up the call without a live Q&A, and I apologize. Should you have any questions at all, please email us anytime, and we'll address them with a follow-up phone call or a response in your email. So unfortunately, that's not going to work. But Tom or John, if you want to take the first write-in question, please do.
Sure. Thanks, Doug. This is John. So the first write-in question was asking about our point of view regarding gold and silver as a hedge in portfolios. So as we know, interest in gold generally spikes around times of uncertainty. Prices rise along with fear. So is gold a hedge to traditional stocks and bonds? The answer is yes. It has no correlation to stocks and bonds throughout history. But that comes at a cost at times, and gold has historically lagged over the long term with a significant volatility profile. Gold has its periods of outperforming stocks, again, especially during times when elevated fear is in place. But the question for the investor is, can you hold on to gold or silver during the good times when it goes in the opposite direction of a rising stock market? That's a question with a lot of alternative investments. Is they're great for the short-term periods when the market crashes and they hold their value or maybe even go up. But the question is, can you withstand a drawdown when traditional assets are up? The gold market is no different than any other market. If you could somehow time the tops and bottoms, you'd be very well off. But there's just no way to do that. Given gold has had periods just like we're experiencing now where it's risen sharply, and those have always been followed when the fear goes away with a sharp decline. So the other problem with it is how to analyze it as an investment. As we know, gold doesn't produce cash flows. One of the main ways we evaluate stocks and bonds is by discounting cash flows, either dividends for stocks or coupons for bonds. And without those cash flows, it's really hard to estimate an intrinsic value. You're basically betting that you'll be able to sell it to the next buyer at a higher price. And that's just speculation that you think the next buyer is going to be more fearful than you are. Gold is also well known as an inflation hedge, a hedge against the currency's drop in purchasing power. Gold has certainly maintained your purchasing power over the long term, going back to 1973 when the U.S. came off the gold standard. But you have to consider two points. The number one inflation hedge over history has actually been stocks. As corporations are able to pass increases on to consumer, stocks have well outpaced inflation. And two, inflation expectations are low, in spite of the narrative that monetary and fiscal policies we've seen recently, there has been no spark in inflation. In fact, inflation expectations went to near zero during April. So it seems like we're actually fighting deflation as opposed to inflation. And that, of course, could change. We don't know what the economy is going to look like as reopening kind of finally completes and all this pent-up demand is out in the economy. Maybe prices could begin to really rise, but for right now, inflation is not a huge risk to portfolios as we see it. So yes, gold is a hedge, but for a couple reasons, it's tough to evaluate as an investment. Historically, it's lagged stocks and bonds. So we don't view it as a core holding, but for certain investors that have an appetite for a safe haven, could make sense, just because given its uncorrelated nature to stocks and bonds.
Thanks, John. This is Tom. We also had a question submitted just about the the general state of the fixed income markets, more specifically the prospects of owning fixed income in the short term, just given the low level of interest rates, and essentially saying, you know, is there any value in owning parts of the bond market with this low level of interest rates? You know, certainly compared to previous periods where we were at high or what we would at least say normalized rates of interest, and certainly back to the 1980s where, you know, CD rates would pay over 10%, return prospects in this current environment are very, mediocre at best. But ultimately, capital markets work in so much as even in previous periods where we had high rates of interest, those were typically during times of pretty high rates of inflation. So you might have been experiencing a nice return on a CD or a bond, but you're also, your purchasing power was being eroded at a similar rate. So the role that fixed income plays in a portfolio is that of principal preservation and return of capital. What we do a lot at Kavar Capital is trying to compartmentalize the time horizon for certain assets. So if you have a spending need that is in a 3-year or less time frame, fixed income makes a lot of sense because of the variability of the equity markets is hard to predict over that short of time frame. That is conducive to a retiree, to an individual that is sending their kids to college, buying a second home, et cetera. And that volatility dampener certainly has worked in 2020. But there's no doubt that what the Fed is up to is forcing all of us as investors to consider taking risk in our portfolio by keeping rates near zero. An interesting statistic is 80% of companies in the S&P 500 now have dividend yields above the 10-year treasury rate. That's near the highest level we've ever seen. So to the extent investors are becoming more comfortable with the state of the economy and the progression of the virus, it's natural for some dollars to begin leaving safe haven investments in finding their way into higher risk investments such as equities, real estate, and the like. So I know it can be frustrating at times to have such low yields on cash and short-term instruments, but the reality is inflation is next to nothing at this point. So on a nominal basis, it's low, but on a real basis, it's probably consistent with what we've seen historically. And it does definitely make the case for owning equities over long term a little more compelling in this environment. I'll stop there. Those were the kind of the two main questions that we received prior to the call. We also had a lot of questions about the election. We plan to put out more information on the election as we move forward, to Doug's point. But please follow up with any specific questions you have for anybody on the team. Be happy to answer those.
Absolutely. And thank you all for taking the time to dial in and for your continued confidence in our team at Kavar Capital. It really means a lot to us to have the opportunity to work with the special families that we do. And for you to take your time to be with us tonight means a lot as well. So we will be in very close touch, and please don't hesitate to reach out. Our apologies again for the technological snafu, and have a great evening. Thanks again.